Good evening, everyone. Thank you for inviting me to contribute to this debate. When I was first asked to contribute, I was asked to talk on the topic of intellectual property theft in universities. My response to that was, yes, we are aware that that kind of thing is happening, but my background is very much from a research point of view, and this is the centre that I run looks at some of these issues. So therefore, rather than talking about what is the state of play in terms of intellectual property theft within universities, I thought I would talk more generally in a research context. If I can figure out how to...
It's the spacebar.
Oh, right, thank you. So, as was evident in the last couple of talks, data and the protection of data is absolutely critical. Apparently, each day we create of the order of 10 to the 18 bytes of data. To a layperson, that's 2.5 million trillion bytes. In other words, an awful lot. 90% of the world's data, I'm given to believe, has been created in the last 2 years, albeit the content of that may not be particularly significant. We see an evolution of the internet into much broader domains. It's not just the IT systems and the IT services. We see the evolution of the so-called Internet of Things, where, in fact, we have the internet is connected to physical devices, physical infrastructure, and we see a vast proliferation of that also when we talk about mobile communication devices. The UK's economy is increasingly dependent on the internet, and, well, I don't really have to say very much. Apparently, 93% of large corporations and 76% of small corporations suffered breaches last year. So the challenge, I think, in trying to lay it out for the research community is we must try and think and try and develop systems that have a strong ability, first of all, to extract meaningful information, whilst at the same time trying to produce systems that provide assured levels of privacy and trust. Now, I sit on the Cyber Growth Partnership, which involves government and industry. But one of the things that keeps coming up is what's the role of the academic community in all of this? And there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect there. So I have taken this information from a brochure that the research councils have recently produced. And I want to give you, first of all, a flavour of what's going on in academia in general, and then I want to give you a flavour of what we do in our Innovation and Knowledge Centre. So first of all, RCUK state that currently there is £82 million being invested around 96 projects. Of course, that's part of the equation. There's also significant other research going on in universities, funded by European programmes, funded by business industry, multinational companies, and so on and so forth. In the last year or so, there has been a major initiative to create these EPSRC GCHQ centres of excellence, and there are now 11 of these throughout the UK, which my own university, Queen's University in Belfast, is one of those designated universities. There'd be also major research institutes. One is the EPSRC, two GCHQ research institutes. One is the Science of Cybersecurity, involves seven universities. It's led by UCL. There's an Institute on the Automatic Program Analysis and Verification, led by Imperial. Two recent doctoral training centres, which aim to create 60 new PhDs over the next 7 years. And then I will refer to the Innovation and Knowledge Centre that I am responsible for at Queen's. Innovation and Knowledge Centres were created a number of years ago to try and address the issue that often arises in some of the discussions about research. UK very strong on research, publication-wise, rated number two in the world. But there's also this challenge in terms of the translation of that research into wider economic benefit. So the purpose of IKCs is to try and provide mechanisms to accelerate, without compromising, I should say, the quality of that research, is to accelerate that out for wider economic benefit and good. And we obtained one of these in cybersecurity in 2009. It's funded by EPSRC, the Technology Strategy Board. Our local regional development agency, Invest Northern Ireland, is funded also by industry and, of course, by the university. So the headline figure for that was of the order of 30 million over the first 5 years, and we currently have now grown that to the order of 80 people. We have a first pipeline of PhDs graduated this year, and there's another 25 in the offering and hopefully many more in years to come. So this Centre for Secure Information Technologies we badge as a global innovation hub for cybersecurity. And there's two very strong and complementary aspects of that. First of all, we don't want to compromise the quality of the research. Second of all, this is a huge area. It covers a wide spectrum, and it's not possible for one university to do all of that. So therefore, we've decided to be focused. And our main areas of interest are in the areas of network security, data security, cyber physical systems, and more recently in mobile security. On the other side, however, we believe we've created a fairly unique open innovation model to try and do the translation process. And it has a number of key characteristics. The first one is the observation that people, I think, in my opinion, make the mistake of thinking the crazy scientist, engineer, whatever, the researcher, is also going to be the best kind of entrepreneur, or in fact is the sort of person that will do that translation. My observation is that whilst there's some unique people that can do, in the main, what we really need is staff that are dedicated to that function. So with the university's grace, we set up a new kind of contract modelled on what you get in a high technology business, and we recruited experienced industrial engineers whose role is not to do paper publishing and grants type things, but is actually to talk to business and industry, try and understand those problems, and then act as the interface between that and the academic base. Also create things like proof of concept demonstrators and so on and so forth. We have a tiered membership model that I'll refer to, I'll discuss in a minute. But the whole aspect of that then is to help translation of ideas into either big industry or creation of startup companies or a whole range of other support for SMEs and so on. So we operate a much more kind of US-style open innovation membership model. What we're trying to do is engage with organizations that are perhaps an earlier stage than is the norm to understand what their problems are and to try and make sure that we're not compromising our research, but we're trying to understand it from both persons' point of view. These bigger companies actually pay money to be part of our function, and they sit that gives them early access to the IP. They sit on an advisory board, and they every so often come along and they critique what we're doing, and they help very strongly work with us to shape our future strategy and research agendas. Now, we don't want many of those you'll recognise as being major companies, quite a number in the UK, but also international companies. Cisco, for example, we also work with Cisco San Jose. We signed an agreement with Infosys, the major Indian software provider, albeit they do an awful lot of the software for the City of London. And then we have an associate membership model, which is cost less. It's mainly targeted towards SMEs. And in addition to that, we have representation from all of the main government agencies with interests in this area. Now, I don't have time in a short presentation like this to tell you all of what we do, so I'll just give you a quick overview and a quick run-through. Our data security systems research is led by Professor Maya O'Neill. She's looking at a range of things, but these include taking cryptographic algorithms and implementing these in a very highly optimized manner. She's looking for low-cost implementations on chip designs, and she's also looking for low-power solutions, and has achieved quite a lot in that domain. More recently, she's working in the area of homomorphic encryption. This is a joint project with Thales, UK. We hear a lot about the cloud. Normally, when you need to work on information in the cloud, you have to decrypt it first and work on it and then encrypt it again. This potentially allows you to work on that information without having to decrypt it. The challenge and the problem, however, is it's horrendously computationally intensive, so we're trying to produce and look at research for new solutions for that. Common perception is that the only thing that matters in terms of crypto is the strength of the mathematical strength of the algorithms, i.e., you know, you can run today's computers for the end of the earth and you'll never crack these. But as Maya and others have shown, if you take something like, a simple chip and pin device, a smart card, or any of these other devices, you can, by looking at and observing the power signature or indeed the electromagnetic signature being emanated, you can crack these fairly easily and comfortably. So I should emphasize it's not our job to be involved in subversive type activities that does this, but rather the research is targeted at trying to develop countermeasures to make these things much more robust and less vulnerable. And also she's looking at so-called physically unclonable functions. These are there's a number of ways of implementing that, but one example is where you take is that whilst logically a chip implementation should function in the same logical manner, not every chip is the same. In fact, even variations between wafer to wafer and indeed from die to die are such that those materials differences can be used to create a unique digital fingerprint for these devices. So those potentially, say, could be embedded into your smart card, making that much, much more robust. And such devices we see as being used in IP protection, anti-counterfeiting, secure key storage, and many other applications. And one of those is a joint program. It's a $2 million program that we're engaged with ETRI, which is the major government electronics telecommunications research institute in Korea. It's a joint project with LG, and the application here is the charging of electric vehicles. So what this is being used to, as well as all the other more sophisticated methods, is to create an anti-tamper device whereby when you pay for the charging of the device, it's charged to your credit card and not to the guy next door. Now that in itself is an interesting application. It's being rolled out across Seoul as we speak. However, the wider application of that is across a range of other major applications, not least smart meters. We talk about the smart grid, the vulnerabilities of that. And also, more generally, these people have told me that some of the headline kind of hacks or break-ins, for example, Microsoft and Sony, etc., were the result of using backed off older technology. So with these kind of new standards being developed, with the addition of the PUF technology, hopefully this makes those kind of things much more robust. Professor Shakir Cesaire leads the activity in network security systems. The group undertake things like denial service mitigation and detection, cloud security. Smart grid is an important application, and more recently in mobile malware, and particularly looking at things like zero-day attacks, signature extraction, and so on. And this is a joint program that's going on with McAfee here in the UK. Over the last number of years, there's been a large proliferation of both Android devices, but also Android apps. It's estimated that there's now been about 25 billion downloads of those. About 23% are believed to be of low quality, and about 2% of those malware. The graphs here, which come from different sources, both show the same trend, much more rapidly growing problem within that space. Now, the conventional way to detect malware is, for example, to take well-known signatures of known malware and do a comparison. However, if that is the first time you've seen it, then in reality, you've no way of overcoming that. So what they have observed is that the kind of software, they see characteristics or similar characteristics in the opcodes that's been used in a range of these things, and they're developing techniques which we could call a sort of an opcode DNA fingerprint for some of this software. And the aim here really is to be able to provide a mechanism where that can be flagged, that can be detected at an early stage. So that gives you an overview of, it's only a small snapshot of what we do. Right from the start, we've taken the view that this is not just a UK problem, this is very much an international problem. And as an academic institute, it's only our responsibility to make those very strong links. So we've developed very strong links in the US, for example, with the Sci-Lab at Carnegie Mellon University, with Georgia Tech Research Institute, and with Stanford Research Institute. I've mentioned the links with South Korea, and also more recently developing links with India. But in terms of an innovation knowledge centre as well, we also see a responsibility in terms, and particularly with our funder, InvestNI, of having a regional impact as well. It was mentioned earlier on that I look after this research institute, ESIT. It's the flagship for the Northern Ireland Science Park. We established that in 2004. when we did. This was a completely brownfield site. It was based on the old Harland and Wolff shipyard site, and that dry dock that you see in the middle of the slide is a dry dock for the Titanic. It was finally kitted out before its maiden voyage. We've managed to survive a little bit longer than that, and 10 years on, we've contributed to an environment that has created of the order of 2,000 jobs and 119 companies, and some of those are in this area. For example, a company called Q1 Labs lives next door. They were invested from the States. They were taken over in the last few years by IBM, and so they're the mainstream activity in cyber within IBM. It was also mentioned earlier that the Royal Society that we now tonight are in has itself undertaken and is undertaking a new policy investigation into the area of cybersecurity research. And if you bear with me, I'll just say a few words about that. Ben Copelman, who's heading that up within the Royal Society, is in the audience, and I think Ben would welcome any thoughts, inputs from those in the audience that would like to find out more, and I'm more than happy to discuss myself. As we are aware, very much cybersecurity transcends international borders. There's quite a number, in fact, there's no end of national cybersecurity strategies, the US, EU, and of course there's a major one here in the UK. In 2011, £650 million was allocated, and then more recently, I believe, another £250 million on top of that. Now, it was pointed out to us when we were doing this, when we're trying to get this started, that this is a very crowded space, and what can something like the Royal Society do that others aren't? We've taken on board all those comments, and I think what we've really, our thought processes are, we've heard a lot tonight, for example, about the really, really serious and important threats that are happening here and now, and the need to be able to mitigate those threats. But also in terms of the research community has as its remit to start looking to the future and looking over the horizon. And so the Royal Society science policy is there to try and develop a high-level vision to help frame a cross-sector research agenda to complement and enhance those other initiatives. Our terms of reference are, what are the major research challenges, not just here, but generally, in the next 5 to 10, or indeed, as some of my colleagues have said, 15 years out, and what policy frameworks, if any, are needed to address those. We believe that that's consistent with the government aim for cyber research in the terms of the Government Office of Science and Innovation, in terms of strengthening the research agenda, bringing coherence to it, and also supporting the application of this research for a wider benefit. The kind of things that this is at the very much at the relatively early stage so far, but the kind of priorities, what are the research priorities, what are the challenges, what are the gaps, and this is where I think the kinds of people in this room can also help assist with that. How do we, it was said earlier, enhance these partnerships between in government, industry and academia, obviously clearly important in terms of this challenge, and also how do we facilitate perhaps a greater international collaboration in some of these longer-term research challenges. My own belief is that at each generation of the computer industry, things start to change. And my belief is that we are seeing one of these kind of paradigm shifts. Now, where will we be in 5, 10, 15 years? And our US colleagues are very good at being able to anticipate this and seeing wider commercial benefit. So we also are interested in seeing what are the commercialization opportunities and what, if anything, is missing so that we can take better advantage of those. The steering committee, which has been established, comprises a number of fellows of the society, comprises a number of professors, senior professors in the universities, some of which I've described. It also comprises people representing at senior level, Google, Facebook, IBM, and Intel, those people being based here in the UK. So we're starting to do some brainstorming on it. I should strongly emphasise that this slide is not anywhere near the tablets of stone, quite the reverse. But these are the sorts of think more longer term issues that are we're starting to think about. Some of these may be pie in the sky, some of them may be old hat, but some of them I think are very real, and we are out, if you like, road testing this right as we speak. The sustainability of cyberspace, we've heard about all the problems, we've heard of all the challenges. You know, will we have a cyberspace 10, 15 years now? People were saying, it's like the ecosystems. Will they be around for our children? A key issue that keeps coming up is privacy and trust. So we've heard about attacks and defence of those attacks, but kind of going the other way, how do we ensure privacy and trust in our networks of the future? And indeed, as I was talking to people last night, more in the critical infrastructure side, how do we also ensure the safety of people, whether those might be on things like trains or planes or whatever. I mentioned this movement towards the internet being connected to physical devices, and of course then there's the whole issue of cyber in its wider socio-economic context. But this is very much, and I think Hugh was alluding to this, this is partly a technology issue, but in fact the whole behavioural aspect of this is extremely important, so is the ethical issues, and so on. So those are just some of the things that we're currently starting to think about. So I hope that gives you an overview. It's a bit of a quick whirlwind through a brief summary of what... There is a lot of things going on in the UK research and academic system. It's starting to build very strongly. I've tried to give you an overview of what we're trying to do within our university to make stronger connections between the research-based industry and academia, and I've then given a brief summary as to where we are with this important policy project within the Royal Society. Thanks very much indeed for your attention.